Hi, and welcome to Vibrant Health with Health Coach Donna. Today I'm interviewing Susan Tate. And although Susan Tate is a recognized worldwide as an author, teacher, and wellness visionary, she loves being a mother and a grandmother and treasures those titles above all others. Susan is the author of four books. The book that we're going to talk about today is one of my favorites, Into the Mouths of Babes, a whole foods nutrition guide to feeding your infants and toddlers. She also wrote Wellness Wisdom, 31 Ways to Nourish Your Body, Mind, and Spirit. She's an international speaker, NIA Black Belt instructor, sexuality educator, holistic health coach, and former assistant professor in the School of Medicine and director of health promotion at the University of Virginia. She's a health educator for over 45 years, and Susan now lives in the Seattle area. If you want to learn more about Susan, you can go to her website at www.susantate.org, and that's SusanTate.org. So welcome, Susan, and thanks for being here today.
You're so welcome, Donna. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm very excited and tickled.
Oh, that's great. Well, I just, like I told you, I just finished your book, and I really enjoyed the way it gave not only information about how to feed your kids, but just generally healthy information for the whole family. And I really appreciate that about this book.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I'd love for you to talk a little bit about is something that you don't normally see in a book about health and food and wellness is the seven sacred nutrients. And I actually I dog-eared the book because I love this section. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what are those seven sacred nutrients.
Thank you so much for dog-earing the book. I think that you found what I believe to be the centerpiece of this third edition of this book. I wrote the first edition when I was a young mama in Virginia in 1984. And this edition, after all of these years, came to me, the centerpiece with these seven sacred nutrients really seemed to almost override the fats, the carbs, that when do you introduce this? All of those things are in the book. There is a definite how to, when to introduce, all of those things, food allergies, everything you'd want to know while, you know, you're eating while you're pregnant and afterwards for the family. But it seemed to me that when we sit around a table, when we get a chance to sit around a table, which is sometimes hard to do in these busy days, that the overriding way that we can really nourish our family would be through adding these seven sacred nutrients. And these you will not find on food labels. You won't find them at the grocery store. The wonderful thing is they're free, and you can use them in unlimited quantities, and they never expire. And so I'll just list them briefly, and then tell me if you want a little bit more information from there. The seven sacred nutrients are, but not limited to, joy, wisdom, respect, quality, safety, pleasure, and my all-time favorite, love. I actually have a spice tin that says love on it that I wish I could find out more. Somebody should make them. I do make little ones for people, but it's, you know, says give them in unlimited quantities. It's immeasurable. But if we sprinkle love on everything, metaphorically, I think it makes the food much tastier.
It reminds me of that movie like Water for Chocolate, where her emotion went into the food, and then people who ate the food felt the emotion.
Oh, and that just tickles me. I haven't thought of that film in quite some time. And the work of Candace Pert, psychoneuroimmunology, would take us back to that if we think that the food tastes like love, then it does. Mm-hmm. And if we think that it's bad or sinful, then that doesn't feel so good in our body. So that's a great, and plus chocolate, I think, is one of the major food groups.
I agree with you.
Not this podcast. But, yes.
So I understand introducing joy with feeding children, and but what can you explain? And if I'm not getting that correctly, you can definitely add. But I think people can understand joy. But what? How's wisdom go into your food? What does that mean?
Thank you. That's a great question. With every bit of information, the nutritional information that is available to us now is infinite and conflicting.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be 10 nutritionists on one side of a table and 10 nutritionists on another. It will give you the science to prove this conflicting, like there will be conflicting evidence.
Yeah.
So within the realm of wisdom, I believe that the parents know best for their child, and accessing that innate wisdom and their intuition on top of that, I believe can override many other things. So using our wisdom as a mama, and even a new mom, inside, I hear so many mothers will say, I had a feeling that they shouldn't be having milk, you know, but the pediatrician said it was okay, you know, and come to find that this child is lactose intolerant, and the mother knew it in advance. Mm-hmm. That's the wisdom that I'm talking about. Trusting yourself in a world that sometimes says, I'm the expert, including everything I wrote in my book. Let your own intuition override it all.
Right. And so that feeds into a little bit about the other sacred nutrient of respect. And I think that we have really changed from, I remember when my mom was growing up, and sometimes parts of, I remember not with my mom, but my aunt. She made me sit at the table until I ate the tomatoes. And I still don't love tomatoes today. I mean, they're okay, but as a kid, I just did not like tomatoes. And being forced to sit there at the dinner table alone with a tomato in front of me led me to put it in my mouth, pretend I ate it, went to the bathroom and spit it out and flushed it down the toilet. So, you know, I'm a good problem solver,
yes,
but that was not really respectful of how I felt about food. And is that kind of what you mean? Because I know we, as parents, we need to, the kids might just right off say no, because they don't, it's different. They don't like the color, the texture. There's lots of things to it that can make a kid like or dislike a food. But you, so where is that respect of the children's desires and taste, but also with trying to get kids to try new foods?
First, Donna, I love your example of the tomatoes in the toilet. I had carrots in the toilet. What about me? Because I wasn't allowed to go trick-or-treating unless I ate my carrots. My mom thought she was, you know, always being a good mom. And so that was, you know, how some people are. So forgiveness is a key there. And I think you're exactly right. With the sacred nutrient of respect, I advocate respecting your child's tastes. And I often say, like, if I was sitting in a chair and somebody was force-feeding me as an adult, you know, you have to eat your beans, you have to eat your kale, you have to... And if I didn't like it, like, the children will have their taste. They will, and on any given day, I remember when my daughter was in middle school, we passed the brown rice around and she let it go. And I said, oh, you're not going to have any rice. And she said, no, I don't like it, which every day up until that day she had.
Exactly.
And I just cracked up and it was like, yeah, somebody in school probably it was like, okay, today she didn't like it. And so respecting our infants, toddlers, and children's tastes as we would want other people to respect our own is really sacred in this sense. And that the conflict comes, I think, with, but they're not getting enough green vegetables. They're eating too much fruit, or they're eating too much this. And so we kick in, or I would, you know, sometimes automatically kick into, but I want to make sure they're having really good food. And trusting, I remember reading a research article for the very first edition in the 80s about babies, a study that was done, if babies were deficient in potassium, and they put several things on their high chair, they would reach for the banana.
So they knew.
That fascinated me. And so allowing that within reason, and if you have a picky eater once they get older, I often advocate letting the child go to the store with you and say, what color vegetable do you want to pick this week?
Mm-hmm.
And do an add-on with giving them control. That's the respect. And it builds them, I think it builds them up. And I don't think you can go wrong.
Right. I love that. But it doesn't mean that you didn't offer your child brown rice again in the future.
Exactly.
Right? I think the thing is that there's that line between respect and forcing them, but also continuing to offer it as an option, because you want them to continue to have the options of tasting those things. Now, my son is 12. He never liked avocados. He still doesn't like avocados. It's okay.
You probably never like avocados.
That's okay. There's more for me.
It's interesting as you say that. I think sometimes, especially depending on how we were parented, there is a sense of we're being good parents when we make our kids eat good foods.
Right.
And that's different. And sometimes I really think it's not even conscious. I really believe that we could so easily be wanting to do such a good job that we unconsciously, quote, force feed. Like,
right.
No, you have to have this. And I don't know about you, but I'm just so darn stubborn. Those carrots did end up in the toilet, and your tomatoes did end up in the toilet.
Yes.
So why not give them a choice and trust them? They will be stronger for it.
And I agree. And that brings me to another thought of respecting is also respecting them when they say they're full. I think that is part of, I didn't get force-fed things, but I do remember having to clean my plate because some children were starving somewhere in the world and me cleaning my plate would make up for it. And of course, it's, you know, it's all good intention and making sure you get enough food and that sort of thing. But I think that that is part of what has thrown off our society in our listening to our cues of fullness. We're kind of use visual cues of the plate size or the bowl size versus, oh, my brain is telling my stomach, I'm actually full. Is that part of, what would you say about that?
I love that you brought that up because, again, I think that the children are incredibly wise, and as we are, but somewhere we may have forgotten how wise we are. And in a world where, you know, I also had to eat everything on my plate before leaving the table, and didn't feel good, you know, sometimes because of it. And so there are sometimes parents who want to do the right thing. I think there's a piece of, but I want to make sure you get enough. And it's a different paradigm. It's different than what many of us were raised with. And so when the child pushes the plate and says they're full, again, if I would do that and say I'm full and someone is saying, eat, keep eating, it's just like, what? No, thank you. I'm pleasantly full. Thank you. And I don't like to waste food. So but I will take it home with me, or, you know, do something like that. So I love that you brought it up. The child will say, I'm done. And respecting their tastes, I think they'll thank you for it.
Yes. And then what about the quality and safety of food? Parents get so many mixed messages about what to buy organic, you know, what not, you know, that sort of thing. I know that I often tell people, if you're not going to buy all organic, at least look at the Dirty Dozen list by the Environmental Working Group. What do you have to say on that, on quality and safety issues?
The quality piece is, I would repeat exactly what you just said in choosing organic when you can, and when you can't, be aware of what is, what you can, you know, if you can possibly use information from that list. The other piece of that is to not guilt trip yourself if you're feeling you can't afford it. Like, mm-hmm. do the best you can. I love Mark David, who is Institute for the Psychology of Eating, the founder of Institute for the Psychology of Eating, talks about the 80-20 rule. And I love the 80-20 rule. And that's mm-hmm. 80% choose and buy the best that you can. 20% love it, bless it, cut yourself a break. You know, don't guilt trip yourself, because it won't digest well. And we can't, as parents, you know, I remember vividly, you know, what the food budget was. And now the term organic did not exist in the 80s and 90s, or maybe it did in the 90s, but not when the children were babies. And looking at the best you can do with what you have to work with, mm-hmm. buying locally anytime that you can, looking in the pantry to see, are there foods in the pantry that are, you know, kind of filling up foods but not necessary? Can I trade that bag of chips for some radishes, you know, something from the outside edges of the store, I think would be really important. And doing the best you can. I remember being on a webinar when somebody had said, you know, they were someplace and their kids were hungry and they stopped at McDonald's and felt horrible. They just felt horrible. And I said, you know, I use McDonald's all the time, but for the bathroom. food. I stop at McDonald's to go to the bathroom. But so you have a happy meal. You know, like, what, like, not every day, not all the time. I'm so not a fan of fast food. I'm really, really not. But sometimes you just cut yourself a break. Do the very best you can. The idea with safety, I added that for several reasons. One, the safety, things like how hot the milk is, how hot the rice is, if you take something out of a microwave, if you use a microwave, testing that before the baby gets it, that kind of safety. Are they okay in a chair? Are they situated in a way that they're not going to fall out? What's within reach of them at different times? But the other part of safety that I added that I really am passionate about is emotional safety. Mm-hmm. And so emotional safety means if you're sitting at the table, then the guidelines are that no one is yelling at anybody. No one is bullying anybody. If someone in the family or around the family is in that sense, what that does to the food and to the child is not safe. And so I added an emotional quality that that I think it's important to speak up and support when we can. The children need us to do that.
Well, I love how you added pleasure to the list as well, because often dinner tables can be emotionally upsetting, even if maybe it's a political discussion or something like that. But to have it in more of an environment where you can easily eat and digest your food is really important, because I think people forget that all that kind of stress and input, it decreases the hydrochloric acid of the stomach because your stress hormones are going and you're not going to digest your food and you're not going to get your nutrients in. And that makes me think back to the McDonald's example. Is we have to, I believe that we have to be very careful about labeling food good or bad, because sometimes in a pinch, for example, an airport. I know airports are getting much better with their food choices, but sometimes you're, as a parent or just as a traveling human, you're stuck and you're starving and you're stuck in an airport. And if you bite into this food thinking how horrible it is for your body, it's labeling it good or bad. And sometimes we just, like you said, we have to do the 80-20 rule. But I also think it's important to for children not to label things good or bad, because it's kind of like a black and white situation that they don't know the subtleties of what you mean.
I think you're exactly right, and I recall when I was working at the University of Virginia, one of my health education colleagues from another university, we were out to dinner, and she and I said something about, this was in the 90s, and I said something about, oh, look at that chocolate mousse, it looks sinful. Because I'd heard that phrase, and that meant it was really, really good. And she very sweetly and very gently was the first person I ever had rephrase that. And she said, you know, we're just learning how important it is to not use that term for food because of the cortisol dump in the body. You think you're, you know, doing something wrong, and you eat, it's sinful. It's not going to go down and digest, as you just said. And I was fascinated. And so I encourage people who are listening to observe without judgment, like don't smack yourself, you know, because you said it was sinful or, but I just listen now and I still hear it. And I just observe how we are taught that some foods are bad. And then we, you know, guilt trip ourselves. The world is tough enough, you know, like we need that sacred nutrient to love on ourselves. So I really encourage people to add the pleasure to the food. When I eat chocolate mousse, it is the most blissful chocolate mousse that it can be. And it feels good in my stomach. And the pleasure around the table, I wanted to just add to that. We had it. I don't remember, it must have been an unspoken expectation, and I say expectation rather than rule because I don't know about you, but rules are made to be broken. I asked anytime I could. But the expectation was that our dinner table was only for positive discussion. And there it didn't mean we were squelching anybody and saying, no, you can't talk about that, but after dinner, before dinner, yes, but at the table was a sacred time that we actually began with a blessing of, if you don't bless the food, then breathe, you know, take 3 breaths before to just honor the people that made the food and grew the food and got it on your table and the people that cooked it. And adding that pleasure is something, and taking the cell phones away from the table, which, mm-hmm. again, I did not have to deal with, and oh my gosh, I just can't imagine. I think it would be really hard to do, you know. But we didn't answer our phone during the dinner conversation, which is huge. But that was a time, it meant when they walked in the door, we could say what was the best part of your day. And I remember my son saying, I didn't have a best part of the day. Something on the bus took my finger. And didn't, you know, then, but not at the dinner table. Or the breakfast table. So just a suggestion, a guideline, and, you know, just do the best you can with what you have to work with.
That is so true. And I love how you suggest start with a ritual, because sometimes we just serve the food and then we just all start eating, and it takes someone 45 minutes or even more sometimes to prepare this meal that's gobbled up in 10 minutes. So slowing down and enjoying your food and having a conversation and starting with a few breaths or some kind of, we do a goofy little bon appetito thing that whenever anybody comes to our house, everybody loves it and they start their own tradition in their home. And it just kind of evolved, and it allows us to just kind of, we've put all the food on the table, and it gives us a moment to just, okay, I'm present, I'm here, I'm going to begin eating. And that's important to let your body know, okay, food's coming, let's get in a good place to digest.
I love the bon appetito. That sounds really, really fun. And I think as you say that, I'm reminded of how our American culture, one, is really hung up on food way more than some other cultures, and that I'm judging, I'm making a judgment collectively, like, Our meal times have become this rushed, or sitting in front of the TV, or it's a different life that some people have, and unless we mindfully reshape it. And so, you know, you don't get the family all together, you know, because of everybody's schedules. But maybe on Wednesdays, you start with Wednesday dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and something to do that. And I'm thinking, my daughter married a man from Austria, and I've been over to his family several times. They eat for hours.
I know, it's so delightful, isn't it?
There's flowers on the table. That, like, and dinner time goes, now it goes way too late for me, but the pleasure of the food and the, there's, you can't, I can't get that back. You know, that's, it's a special time, and I feel lucky that we had that with our children, and that they're doing that with their children now.
That's wonderful.
Food is really special, and it's a gift of love.
So that, and that brings me to another question. There are some parents who, with small children, feel that they're going to feed the kids early and feed them a separate meal, and then later the husband and wife will eat a different meal. And often I see that the kids get the tater tots and the simpler foods earlier in the day. They feed them at 5, and then the husband comes home or the mom comes home, and it's a kind of a different way of it's almost like separate eating, separate meals. It's a whole different approach. Do you have any suggestions or ideas around that?
That is a fascinating question that I think I have never had anyone phrase it. So I want to thank you for asking it. And I'm looking at the first thing is not judging anyone's lifestyle. It may be that that is the only way they can pull off dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Just may be. I would encourage, like, rather than the tater tots, to be sure, like, what, like, I believe that what giving our children the gift of good nutrition is a lifetime gift. And some people didn't. See, we didn't get that at home, so we may not have received that at home, and so we copy or we do something opposite. I would suggest, if at all possible, knowing how life is so busy and crazy, depending on what time one of the partners comes home, I would suggest, if at all possible, having a family mealtime. And maybe it's breakfast. You know, mm-hmm. Maybe it's hard to do lunch if there's people working outside the home. But to look at the quality in all of the nutrients, the joy, the wisdom, the respect, you know, the safety, the pleasure, the love, if that can be pulled off in kind of separate eating times, and that's what works best and feels really healthy for your family, then that's what works well for you.
Yeah.
But I think people would know. I would say observe what feels good and at what time maybe a child, you know, gets to a certain age, and it's really personal. It's often, I'm thinking of the Austrian example, it's tradition. Is that a tradition you may want to continue, or would you want to change it?
Yeah. Yeah. And go ahead. Were you going to say something else?
No, I just really appreciate it. Again, the I think overriding in all of my books, I do not judge. Like, judge not, lest you be judged. People could judge me for many things.
And we do have to appreciate that everybody has their own circumstance in life and they're doing the best they can. And I think what you said is really important. Pick one or two days where maybe you can have a dinner together. Maybe it's your Sunday meal together. And the rest of the week is just, you know, crazy between soccer and basketball and whatever else is going on. I completely understand that, and I appreciate that perspective. So when we're feeding children and we're nutrienting them, one of the things that I talk about with adults is that our food sources are not as nutrient dense as they used to be. And people say, well, what about if I get organic? And I've read that organic has a little bit more nutrients, but it really comes down to the soil depletion of nutrients. And I know that the American Medical Association has also recommended now supplementing a healthy diet with nutritional supplements. It's something that I am very clear with my patients that I feel that a good diet also includes a high-quality nutritional supplement. But what do you feel about children?
I'm almost jumping up and down, but the people won't be able to see me jumping up and down. I'm really glad you asked the question, and it's something that over the decades of watching and feeding and learning about nourishment and soil depletion has fascinated me. So when I grew up, a tomato was so good. I know you don't like tomatoes. It's a terrible thing. So sorry. But the vegetables, we got them out of our garden. We got them out of our garden, or we got them locally. They didn't come from states that were really far away, or countries that were really far away. Now, I'm obviously dating myself with this, but that's the difference in what has happened. Like, our soil isn't like the soil that our grandparents picked their vegetables from. The spinach does not have the nutrient density and content that it did. So I had to be convinced about supplements, I have to say, about 10 years ago, because I ate all organic food and and all of this, and learning so much about what the toxins, and I'm such a positive person, even to say toxins is kind of hard for me, but so the toxins and the stress, like the stress levels of our lives, make our food not digest as well. So I am 100%, I believe that adults need to take supplements and not just any supplement, and that children absolutely from ages 2 on need to take a high quality supplement. Can I mention a name?
Yes.
Okay, my favorite, and I am an associate with the company, so I'm going to say that up front, but I don't put my name by anything that I'm not going to stand right next to. USANA Health Sciences, USANA, USANA Health Sciences makes the top rated, there are 3 top rated supplements according to the Canadian study that has been out. They've done the study 5 times, and they rated supplements on multiple levels. Our supplements in the United States are just food grade. That means that whatever you put in them, it says the average serving might be this, the average serving. USANA supplements are made by a scientist who cracked the code on what vitamins and minerals are needed to keep human cells alive. That's why I'm behind this company. So I highly recommend the USANIMALS for children, and the essentials for adults, and I'm a huge believer in the prenatals, the USANA prenatals. The prenatals and our essentials are listed in the physician's desk reference. That's almost unheard of. That is the quality. So people will say to me, well, I take vitamins and they don't work. And I gently ask what brand, and I can look up in this research study what the rating is, on a scale of 0 to 5, and I agree, most supplements don't work. So eating good food first and adding supplements, I'll stop now because I'm really passionate about adding that, giving them the edge and knowing what they've done for my body has been incredible.
Yeah. And I'll also add that they do have Body Rocks for teenagers.
Body Rocks, which
I think is really important because teenagers need certain nutrients. And because they're just growing so fast, and their brains are making all these new connections, that it's really important that they get a certain level of nutrient as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you. So, Susan, thank you so much for everything that you've shared here. Is there anything else that you would like to share or end on?
I'd like to share what I share at the very end of Into the Mouths of Babes, and that's that do the very best you can with what you have to work with. And specifically for the moms, please practice good self-care. I did not. I didn't know what that meant. I think 90%, that's a scientific study, not. However many percent of mothers, we put everyone else first. And I did that, and my health suffered in my younger years. And looking back, when I, especially with mothers and fathers, but mothers, it's like, you know, put your oxygen mask on first when you're on the airplane. They're not kidding. And I think that we're almost genetically coded not to do that. And I wrote something called The Voice of Self-Care. And if you go to my website or go to intimateofbabes.com, I think The Voice of Self-Care is on there. But it's the loving voice inside that says, take care of yourself first so that you can take care of the people who really need your care. They will not be optimally nutrienced, you know, in a way, if the mom hasn't had sleep or if she hasn't had a massage or maybe she didn't get her toenails done, you know, just a little. Those were all completely foreign to me. And I really strongly recommend loving on yourself first so we can best take care of these precious souls that are coming into this world right now.
Oh, Susan, thank you so much. And I so agree with you. So remember, everybody, if you want to find out more about Susan, her website is susantate.org, O-R-G. And if, right. And if they want to get a copy of your Into the Mouths of Babe book, what's the best place to find this?
If they go to my website and click on the book section, it will take them, it'll give you a little more info about the book, and it'll take you to a link to Amazon. Your bookstore will have it, or they will order it for you. Your libraries will have it, or they will order it. And I really love it when people, like, my idea would be to have this book in every waiting room for a pediatrician. So that people can just glance at it. So donate one, if please. Donate one to your library. This edition especially is really about spreading the word in a way that I don't, you know, I don't need to make money with the book. I want so much for people to have the information. So please share it. But going to my website and then clicking on books will get you to the Amazon link.
That's great. And just to let everybody know, it's also packed with tons of great recipes in the back. So it's a very practical book where you can get these wonderful recipes to make for your family and your little ones. So Susan, thank you so much. I really appreciate today. And I hope all the listeners enjoyed what we had to say.
Thank you so much. Your questions were extraordinary. And thank you everyone for listening. And please sign up for my newsletter on my website, too. I'd love to connect with you. Thank you so much, Donna.
That's a great idea. So everybody go to susantate.org. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.